Hello. Welcome to Appointment in Time. Today's retrospective looks back at the Pearl Harbor attack. Their voices, their stories, their words. Today we hear how the brave men and women of December 7th, 1941 met and kept their appointment in time.
Announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. Would like to now try to call in Manila, the capital of the Philippine Commonwealth. Go ahead, Manila. This is CBS in America calling Manila. Go ahead. We regret that we are unable to contact either Honolulu or Manila.
There's a flash just received in our newsroom. Dateline Washington. United States Army transport carrying lumber was torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. Details on this news and other news that has been coming in on the Far East situation will be given to you at approximately 3:35 during the intermission of the New York Philharmonic concert. We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The Symphony No. 1 in F minor by the modern Russian composer Shostakovich performed as the opening work on this afternoon's Philharmonic program, Arthur Rudzinski conducting. Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and Manila, the Philippine Islands, from the air. The attack is developing. Today, Dean Taylor's usual commentary will be replaced by a further report on the Far Eastern situation. We pause now for 15 seconds. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is John Daly speaking from the CBS newsroom in New York. Here is the Far East situation as reported to this moment. The Japanese have attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and our defense facilities at Manila, capital of the Philippines. The first disclosure of this news was made by Presidential Secretary Stephen Early by telephone at approximately 2:25 in Washington. I read the text of this historic announcement at a little after 2:30. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. That was Secretary Early's message. Short while later, he dictated another message. A second air attack has been reported. This one has been made on the Army and Navy bases in Manila. And here's a last-minute Associated Press flash from Honolulu. A naval engagement is in progress off Honolulu with at least one black enemy aircraft carrier in action against the Pearl Harbor defenses. Secretary Early informed all correspondents and then rushed to the White House to be with President Roosevelt. As the announcement was made, the two Japanese envoys, Ambassador Nomura and Special Emissary Kurosu, were at the State Department. Columbia's correspondent in London, Bob Trout, heard the news for the first time from our report from New York. Up to that moment, or very shortly before then, the British capital had not been informed of the Japanese attack on the Hawaiian Islands and on Manila. In view of Prime Minister Churchill's recent pledge that a British declaration of war on Japan would follow almost immediately upon the outbreak of war between Japan and the United States, a British announcement is expected soon. Columbia's correspondent, Ford Wilkins, was put on the air in CBS's regular 2:30 news program on Sunday afternoon from Manila. He was cut off the air suddenly while he was talking about air raid shelters, possibly because of censorship. In communication with Columbia's radio station, KGMB, in Honolulu, we heard here in New York that the Pearl Harbor base had been attacked and anti-aircraft fire was heard. A telephone message to the United Press from Fort Schaefer in Hawaii said that 50 planes attacked the island of Oahu. The planes were officially described so far as unidentified in these messages, although later reports that have come in from the press associations definitely identify at least two of these planes as carrying the emblem of the rising sun, the emblem of Japan.
Hello, everyone. I'm James Bostic. Welcome to An Appointment in Time. Today is December 7th, 2025, and the last 5 minutes of radio broadcasts is probably what you would have heard had you been sitting around a radio, as many Americans were on that day, a day not too different from today. It was Sunday. Cold, wintry skies overhead, a little bit of snow here and there on the ground. And it was through broadcasts, just like the excerpts we heard a moment ago, where America found that the war it had so desperately wished to avoid had arrived nonetheless. What you're getting ready to hear are the voices of those survivors of that day, which Franklin Delano Roosevelt so aptly described as living in infamy. Their deeds, their stories, told by the men and women who lived through that terrible day 84 years ago.
7:55 a.m., Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor near Honolulu, Hawaii. Retired U.S. Navy Lieutenant Jim Downing remembers that day as if it were yesterday.
I'd just been married for 5 months. We were having breakfast when the first bombs dropped. We turned on the radio.
And 200 miles off Hawaii, six Japanese aircraft carriers under Admiral Yamamoto had launched 353 aircraft led by Commander Mitsuo Fushida in a surprise attack against the Pacific Fleet. Jim scrambled from his house toward his ship, the USS West Virginia, berthed on Battleship Row.
So the first airplane that came my direction was all drab. I thought it was an Army plane. Then he came flying low and slow. He had machine guns. The bullets went right over my head. That's when the war became very personal.
Simultaneous air attacks were underway at six U.S. airfields. The first wave of attack along Battleship Row crippled or sunk the might of the U.S. Pacific Fleet.
We were tied up with the Oklahoma in front of us and the Arizona behind. The Oklahoma capsized and turned over. So here we were with the Oklahoma upside down in front of us, the Arizona burning like a volcano behind.
Jim first boarded the flaming deck of the USS Tennessee and slid down its 5-inch gun barrel onto the West Virginia. Massive torpedo strikes had already sunk the West Virginia into the shallow waters.
I could see the fire spreading toward the ammunition. I took a fire hose from the Tennessee and tried to cool the ammunition so it wouldn't explode because the fire was spreading to everything above the waterline.
Millions of gallons of crude oil from the USS Arizona, Oklahoma, California, and four other damaged or sinking battleships ignited the water in flames.
Oil is lighter than water, so it stayed at the top. And to see sailors being blown over the side into that oily water, sink underneath, come up, and the oil was on fire, and to see their bodies just burn like a human torch. That was the worst experience I could imagine, is seeing those human torches burning. I ran the whole gamut of emotions. The first was surprise, and then there was fear, and it turned to anger that our leadership had let us down. And then there was pride to see our men without leadership instinctively doing the right thing.
As the second wave of attacks swooped in on the USS Nevada, Jim says he felt peace while fighting the inferno.
I felt like, Lord, I'll be with you in a minute. And I fully expected to be. So I had the deepest peace I've ever felt in my life. And I think that was it. I'm going to be with you in a minute.
Jim's faith in God didn't begin in the heat of battle either.
Years earlier, aboard the West Virginia, a battleship similar to this one, Jim lived and worked alongside a group of Christian shipmates.
I was very unhappy, but Virgil was one of this group. Sing a tune, face shining, looked like he's the happiest person in the world. I knew it was Christ in him. I was attracted to Christ because of the quality of life of the guys I saw who were Christians. It was aboard the battleship West Virginia that I gave my life to Christ because I wanted what these other people had.
Then in that crucial hour when lives were at stake, and later when his shipmates needed comfort in death, God's peace led Jim.
I knew many of them that I saw killed. We lost 108 that morning. They went down fighting. They went down trying to protect the ship and each other. I felt like everybody was a hero.
After all the fires were out, Jim rushed to the hospital. Over 3,500 Americans were dead or wounded.
My friends were burned, so I took a notebook. I went down the line of these guys in suspension and said, if you give me your parents' address and dictate a note, I'll see that they get it. The main surprise was how optimistic they were. And they told their parents, don't worry about it, I'll be all right. And they knew that Jordan would die that night. But I liked their optimism.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
The next day, the United States declared war on Japan.
This was going to be a long war.
Battles in the Pacific theater alone resulted in 35 million casualties, 3% of the world's population. 100,000 civilian casualties at Okinawa heavily influenced America's use of 2 atomic bombs against Japan to end World War II. Jim was stationed in Washington, D.C. at the war's end, grateful the 400 gunnery trainees under his command would enjoy civilian life once again.
We were relieved that it was over. We were too close to disaster. It must never happen again.
At 102 years old, Jim is the second oldest surviving veteran of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
My main admonition out of Pearl Harbor is, remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert and strong, because I believe that weakness invites aggression, and we must never be weak as a nation, or aggression will result.
After Jim retired from the U.S. Navy, to his surprise, he met and befriended Japan's Pearl Harbor attack commander, Mitsuo Fushida.
I met him and talked with him on several occasions. A missionary gave Fushida a Bible, and he became a Christian and became an evangelist.
They fought against each other in war, but through Christ, discovered a brotherhood of peace.
I have a favorite verse, Ezekiel 36:23. God himself said, the nations will know me when they see me in you.
My name is Francis Eamon. That's E-M-O-N-D. I was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and I was raised there until we went through high school. I worked in a mill for a couple of years, and I joined the Navy in 1938.
Is there a legacy of service in your family?
No, there is not. Most of my parents, my family, were French. They came down from Canada to work in the mills in New England.
When you joined the Navy, what was your motivation for doing so?
My main motivation was to get out of the mill where I worked, because it looked like I was going to be there my whole life. So I wanted to do something a little bit more than that. I heard a radio broadcast that the Navy was looking for musicians, and I had been a French horn player in high school, so I applied for the Navy, and I was one of the few to be selected to join the Navy.
Did you enjoy playing the French horn?
Yes, I enjoyed it very much. I played it all the way through high school, but then I hadn't played it for 2 years until I joined the Navy, so it was my instrument.
Tell us a little bit about your training when you joined.
When I joined the Navy, I went to Norfolk for recruit training. And at Norfolk, I received my uniform and a bunch of shots and the indoctrination for about a month into the Navy. And then they sent me back up to Washington, D.C. to the School of Music.
So what was it like playing in the U.S. Navy band?
Well, it was fine playing in the bands. We always enjoyed that. I was assigned to Navy Band Number 8. There was 23 players and one leader. So we lived together and we worked together, and we were a unit. So it was nice to be a part of a group.
Take us through a typical day in the U.S. Navy band, your day, your duty, and what have you.
If it was aboard the ships, of course, I did most of my time on the ships. If the ship was in port, we would play morning colors and then be rehearse a little bit maybe. And then we'd set up during the noontime lunch hour. And we play all through that, and then the evening we would do the same. We were in the evening at noontime we'd play some real light music, and sometime in the evening we would set up a stage band and play some of that, and then some marches and that. If we were at sea duty, if we were steaming at sea on the Pennsylvania, our station was on the aft mast. Top of the mast, we were the surface lookouts, because the ship had no radar in those days, so they had to depend on sailors with the glasses to search the seas for other ships.
Were you stationed on the USS Pennsylvania right from your training?
No. In 1938, when I joined the Navy, shortly after that, when they formed our band, we went on a shakedown cruise of a new light cruiser, the Phoenix, I believe it was the name. We went to South America, on the east coast of South America, down as far as Buenos Aires, and then we came back up the same way. And then we went back to the school for a little more training. Then we went to New York City to Flushing, where they had the 1940 World's Fair there, and we lived in tents on the edge of the fairgrounds, and every day we marched into the fair and we played colors and the arrivals of all the important the visitors they had coming. And after that, we went back to the school for a little more training. And then, that was 39, I believe, not 39. We went to we were assigned to a cruiser in the Pacific Fleet. So we left Norfolk by an ammunition ship and went around through the canal to the west coast. And we joined our ship there. It was a light cruiser, the Honolulu, I believe it was that, was the name of that one. And we stayed on the Honolulu until the middle of 1941, when our Admiral Kimmel was selected to be Sinkpak Fleet. And the Admiral's ship was the battleship Pennsylvania. So when he moved to the Pennsylvania, he liked our band, so we traveled there with him. That was the reason that we were there at the time.
When would you say that you arrived at Pearl Harbor?
Late 39, they sent the Pacific Fleet to Pearl Harbor because they thought eventually that they might be having trouble there. So,
how did your fellow mates and all feel about war with Japan? Did you feel that was coming?
We all thought that it was a possibility. We were lookouts, so they were studying little cards with pictures of Japanese planes and the Japanese ships. So if we happened to see one, we would know what they were. But we were not concerned with it too much.
Take me to the night before that attack on Pearl Harbor.
The night before, we were playing a dance band concert in a big hall on the 1010 dock, and the swing bands were playing, and each band would play a set of three, and then the other band would play another set. One was on one side of the hall, one on the other. And we played that. We did that to about 11 o'clock, a little bit later. And since our battleship was in dry dock close to there, so a lot of our crew were there. So the winner was won by the amount of applause that they received. So we had most of our crew on the ship. So I think that's one of the reasons why we were selected to be the winner of that. The other bands, each battleship had a band, and even though they weren't playing, I think they all come over to listen. So the Arizona band crew was there, and of course they were all about the same age as we were. They were band number 22, and They left about midnight with on their launch to go back to their ship.
All right. Well, take us to December 7th, 1941, and explain that day to us.
In our group of battleships, it was our turn to play Morning Colors, so we were lined up on the firm stern of our battleship. We were in the dry dock, and we were overlooking the whole harbor, and it was a beautiful morning, and we had decided to go play a tennis that morning, but at 5 minutes to eight, we saw a line of planes come in over the left, and small prop planes, and the first one peeled off and dropped something. I thought maybe some of the tail had come off or something, so I watched it until it hit a hangar over on the air station, and that exploded up in the flames and smoke and a lot of noise, which startled us, really. We looked back up and saw the big red spots on the fuselage of the airplanes, so immediately it dawned on us that was the Japanese were there. And at that time, a plane that came down from our left, from the entrance of the harbor, a torpedo plane, and I could see it drop its torpedo right by our stern. It was headed to some ships on the left. I saw the wooden floats come off the torpedo so the torpedoes wouldn't sink in the mud. and the man in the aft cockpit of the torpedo plane had a machine gun that looked like he was firing at us. You could see the red flashes of the machine gun. You could hear the metal clips on the turret behind us. He was shooting a little bit high, but the torpedo went under the, I believe the, it was the Oglala, the a mine lane ship, and hit a cruiser which was alongside it on the pier. And the Oglala was a wooden ship, so I could see all the wood flying up through the air. And at that time, of course, this all happened with a matter of seconds, like it seemed like all the same time, and then we knew we had to get down to the battle station. And at that time, throughout the ship, you could hear the signs: general quarters, no drill. So me and a friend I had, we were assigned to the aft repair party. So we started down that way. As we're going down the ladders, we went through the compartment where we slept. So I took my French horn and I put it under my mattress. I didn't know whether that was going to help or not. But we went down to our repair party and we sat there. Of course, everybody sat on the steel deck because there's no chairs around there. After quite a while, we felt the ship shake. So we know that we had received a bomb hit. The ship got extremely warm because after that there were two destroyers in the dry dock with us, and they were smashed, and all the oil had leaked into the dry dock, was on fire. So the sides of the ship was on fire with all the paint that they had on the ship. And the gunner who was in charge of our group began to get real worried with the heat, because our main guns used black powder, which was very explosive. And he was afraid it'd get too hot, that the powder might explode. But they were able to flood the dry dock a little bit in order to put the fires out. So we were safe from that. But then we got word, my friend and I, who had a stretcher, and that was our job there. So we were assigned to go pick up the dead and the wounded people.
Now, you mentioned when that plane came in, you were close enough to see the bullets coming out of the gun.
Oh, yes.
How close, explain to us how close that really was.
It was probably about 100 foot, maybe 150 foot is all.
So you could see the plane clearly.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And if I close my eyes, I can still see it.
Still see that.
Right.
Now, you said that you were in charge of this, or part of the stretcher crew, so you helped...
Right. There was two of us assigned to the aft repair party. And two other, the BAM was, the members were spread around the ship where they needed men to do stuff like that.
What's the one memory that sticks in your mind from that day?
The main memory was the problem we had trying to pick up someone who was close to the blast of the bomb and the explosions. Because the flesh was all burnt, so you couldn't pick them up by the flesh. You had to pick them up by the shoes, and then the uniform was undershirts and white shorts at that time. So we had a problem getting them up off the deck into the stretcher. And the smell of the burnt flesh is still something that remains with me. So.
And what did you, from there, where did you go?
They were able to repair us enough, because the bomb went down through the middle. It didn't disturb the engines or anything. So I think it was 12 days later we left. We left Pearl Harbor, our battleship, and we had one destroyer as an escort. And we went north looking for the fleets of the Japanese fleets or anything. We went up around Alaska and the Aleutians, and then back down along the coast, the west coast. And about a month later, we arrived in San Francisco, and they put our ship into the repair yards there. And that was when they installed anti-aircraft guns on the ship. All those old battleships, I think there was nine of us, that had no anti-aircraft guns that could shoot at these small planes. So the some of the destroyers, the newer ships, they had some, but our ships, old battleships, we were 20 years or more old. So we didn't have any then, but in the shipyard they installed them on the ship. So.
Now, how many years were you in?
I entered in 38, and I had to leave in 68.
So what was the feeling when you heard that the Japanese had surrendered?
I just don't remember that at all. I mean, it was I had spent the last part of World War II in the Mediterranean as on the ship there as part of the Sixth Fleet, and when that ended, when the war in Europe ended, I came back to Washington to a school, and I got to be the leader of the bands, and I just don't remember, because I was way on the East Coast at that time. And so.
Any other moments that you would like to share with us in your long career?
No, it's I enjoyed being in the service. I enjoyed being the leader of the bands. I had a real talent for being a conductor. So I was a classical conductor, and I enjoyed that very much. I had a 1 3-year period in San Diego. I had a 100-piece band there for that time, which was very, very nice. And I did my last tour in Pensacola. It was very nice there. And after 30 years, I had to retire. So. If they would have let me, I would have been happy to stay another 10 years, because it's nice to be a player in the band, but it's much more fun to be the leader.
So going back one last time to December 7th, remembering that day, what would be something that you remember that made you most proud?
That day, I was very proud of the ability of the crew and to take care of the wounded and get the dead out of the way and everything the way it was handled. That's the bomb went down the midships where the dressing station was. But they had a small one in the stern of the ship, and there was one doctor there. But everyone was taken care of. We were that afternoon. We were issued rifles and ammo to in case they invaded. So we were ready for that. But there didn't seem to be any confusion or anything. We all had the jobs. Specific things we had to do, and everyone was at their jobs.
Once you retired from the service, what did you do in civilian life?
I was a marina manager for ten years, and after that, I was old enough to start Social Security. So I just did a few odd jobs then, but. I had two sons, and they were in college, so I had to keep up a little bit. So we just got along fine. You notice when I get going on Pearl Harbor and talking about the dead people, I start stammering a little bit.
You were awesome.
So it's awesome. So it's a. You just can't help but feel it, even though it was a long time ago.
I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old, with mother's permission. In those days, they had what they called minority crews, and you could go in at 17. So I never finished high school, and I joined the Navy in 1938, so I had over 3 years in when the war started here, and I was right out here on the battleship Oklahoma. And my station was in the engine room, and there were 54 men in my division. So far as I know, only four of us survived out of the 54. There may have been some others, but that's all I had heard of. So I was pretty fortunate there. And I stayed on the ship until it listed about 30 degrees. And then I thought it was time to leave, because 30 degrees is getting over there pretty good. And when I got to the top side, it went on over. My buddy was with me. He went uphill and went over to the battleship Maryland, which we were tied up to. And it was too steep for me to go up there by the time I got out the ventilator, and I slid down into the water. So I had to swim. And
how far did you have to swim?
Well, I swam. Just as I slid down there, the ship turned over onto me and covered me. So I tried to swim out from under it, and I was an excellent swimmer, but I couldn't find the surface. There was something over the top of me. So I finally gave up. And finally, I ended up in a life raft. How I got there, I don't know. I think it was due to either an explosion or the ship making a sudden movement and forced me out of the water. I don't know. But I ended up in a life raft.
Do you think you were unconscious at that time?
As what?
Do you think you were unconscious at that time?
I was. I was, because I had given up. But then after I was in the life raft for a few minutes, got my breath back again, and the fellas had a couple of wounded men in the life raft, and they gave me the dickens for jumping into the life raft. I don't know. I didn't know how I got there. So I knew I wasn't wanted, so I jumped back in the water and started swimming over here to the submarine base. This is what was my goal. And actually, my ship was right out there where the Missouri is. So it's quite a swim from there to here.
Oh, yeah.
But I swam probably a fourth of the way, and I was picked up by a motor launch. But then I got back over here to the submarine base, and I heard that they had heard some tapping on the hull of the Oklahoma. If you've seen pictures of it, about a third of the hull was still above water. And so I went back out there and I worked on it for 2 days. We were cutting people out, and we rescued 32 men. And that's where I spent the next 2 days. And then after that, I went out to sea. I grabbed the first destroyer I could get on and went to sea because I wanted to kill a Jap. That was my goal.
Can you state your name and spell it? Just say it out loud.
Say what?
Just say, say your name.
Walter Becker.
Will you spell it?
Can you spell it for us?
Oh, spell it? Oh, W-A-L-T-E-R. B-E-C-K-E-R. Is it show on there?
Yeah.
Okay.
That way when they're putting it all together, they'll have your name right.
Yeah. But anyway, I went to sea on a destroyer, and 9 months later, it was sunk. We lost it at Guadalcanal.
Oh, wow.
So then I was on an oil tanker for about a year and a half. Then I went aboard a small aircraft carrier, and it was sunk. We lost it at Iwo Jima. So I was a hell of a swimmer.
There you go.
You got lots of practice.
Yeah. But there's not very many people you'll ever talk to that survived three ships.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
How long did you stay in the Navy?
7 years total.
So all of that within 7 years?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, actually within 5 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it was the action was all within about a four-year period.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's about the extent of it.
Tell us what coming here means to you.
Oh, I think about so many of the fellows that were good friends of mine, and I feel that it's pretty much a duty for me to go over here and commemorate them. I just get a different feeling when I'm over here thinking about them, because I did lose a lot of friends. Like on the Oklahoma, we lost 427 men. On the Bismarck Sea, which was the little aircraft carrier, I think there we lost 320, about a third of the crew. So it's been a little rough, but actually I've been fortunate. I had a good life, was married for 63 years. My wife died a little over a year ago, so raised two children. One of them is here with me, and one grandson's here with me. And been fairly fortunate, made a decent living, always had something to eat, had clothes on my back.
What did you do after the Navy?
Well, for the first 10 years, I farmed. And then I hurt my back, and I had to quit farming because I couldn't ride a tractor anymore. And I started selling firefighting equipment. And we built fire trucks until about 3 years ago.
Wow.
Got fire trucks all over the nation.
Great.
Yeah, with my name on them. Yeah.
My name is Don Long. I served in the Navy. I happened to be at Pearl Harbor in 1941 after enlisting in March of 1941. In Minnesota, farm kid, manure still on my shoes, got to Hawaii in November of 1941, was assigned to an aircraft squadron, PBYs. I was a radioman. We were based at Kaneohe Bay in Hawaii. It's right across the island from Pearl Harbor. And that's where I was on December 7th, 1941.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
I'd finished radio school in Alameda and got assigned to Hawaii, which of course I think was every young farm boy's dream in those days. The morning of December 7th, that the squadron that I was in, we had some planes or on the water, and I was in one of those airplanes. It's the procedure is that if there is a plane anchored on the water, that somebody's in it at all times, quote, just in case. I had just relieved the fellow who got off, who was on the plane the night before. It was about 7:45 in the morning, and I was getting ready for the day's activities that we had planned. We were going to do a little signal practicing with the shore, and I heard some airplanes overhead. I looked out, I saw some planes up in the air, thought it was the Army Air Force doing some Sunday maneuvers. Moments later, the planes started coming in my direction, and one of them opened fire, strafing the airplane that I was in. Just about the same time, there were bombs going off, exploding, when the overhead bombers, they were dropping bombs on the shore establishment, on the hangars, the airplanes on the ground. The planes, we had them all lined up there at the base, and the strafing airplanes, the incoming planes, were strafing the planes on the ground and on the water. The plane that I was in was hit, I'm going to say almost instantly. It burst into flame. The gas tanks did not have bulletproof rubber liners in them in those days, and the plane and everything was immediately engulfed in fire. I just happened to be in the middle of it. I can recall seeing the little spouts of water shooting up where the bullets went through the bottom of the plane. This was on my way trying to get out, which I did. I went to the back blister of the airplane and jumped into the water. At the time, the water, of course, was all aflame with gas and oil. But at boot camp, fortunately, they had taught us how to swim through a burning, quote, water. And that's what I did. You just jump in feet first, with hands over your head, such like this, and then go under the water. Stay as long as you can, swim as far away as you can, and then when you need air to come up, and then with your hands, just wave them back and forth, spread the flames, come up for two seconds, gulp of air, go back down, swim off and do it again. So that worked well for me. There was a buoy a couple of hundred yards away that I saw. I swam over to that. My logic at the time, I can recall, was that I thought if they would try to strafe me in the water, if they saw me, that I could climb under that buoy, and I thought I might be protected. That never happened. I want to add there was never any action at me directly. They were attacking the planes and the hangars, but I didn't see anything that I thought was coming after me as an individual. A little while later, I noted a boat was coming out from the shore, and they were out there looking for survivors, and they came over and picked me up. Fortunately for me, but unfortunately for the other guys, I was the only one that did survive the strafing of the planes that were on the water and stuff.
I was a corporal musician on the battleship Tennessee, and my battle station was up in the mast, the top of the mast, as a spotter for the 5-inch broadside guns. Fortunately, the gun battery manned by the Marines was on the starboard side, and they couldn't train the guns out anyhow because they were landing. So there was no, the only guns that fired on the ship were the anti-aircraft guns. When I got up to my station, I put the sound power phones on, talked to the gun crews who couldn't see anything that was going on because they were on the offside. I tried to give them a blow-by-blow account of what I saw from up there. I watched the Arizona go up in a terrible loud noise, and that shattered me right there. And then I looked down at all the flaming oil, and the men had been blown over the side, and my heart went out to them. But the real heroes, in my estimation, were the boat crews and the boats that went in the flaming oil and tried to rescue these men that were floundering. After so long a time and a few machine gun bullets going through my location up on top there, I looked out and saw a Japanese plane that had dropped its torpedo, and as they dropped the torpedoes, they crossed over Ford Island. The West Virginia by this time had had about two or three torpedoes in it. She was tied alongside of us. We were tied just forward of the Arizona and right back of the Maryland and the Oklahoma. As you know, the Oklahoma was torpedoed and capsized. She rolled over. The West Virginia protected us from torpedoes because she took the brunt of the attack, and she went down into the mud, but was still tied to us. The Arizona, of course, was a complete total loss. It was chaotic, but the men responded. We drilled for so often, and we knew what to do, what had to be done, and the men did what they had to do, just like an old newsreel. I remember lots and lots of things. On the day before Pearl Harbor, Saturday, I had committed some minor offense, and the first sergeant took away my liberty, which was my ability to go ashore on Saturday and Sunday, and made me paint the interior of the spotters up there. And I had a bucket of aluminum out of rust paint, and I painted the entire area. And when I came up there, when they sounded general quarters, the first thing I did, of course, was tip over the bucket that I'd left there. So it was a slippery, gooey mess. And unfortunately, the first sergeant came up there, I read later in his report, almost did a pratfall, and was lucky he didn't fall down through the opening in the hatch. Makes me feel very proud to people take enough time and thoughtful enough to come and enjoy this meeting. It does. And I am exalted that I, as it were, I'm the sole survivor of this outfit representing you. I'm sorry that there are not more people with us, but the good Lord giveth and the good Lord taketh away.
Oh man, that was a hell of a day. I was on the boat deck and I saw the first Japanese plane come over. He came over and he dropped the bomb right down the stack of the Arizona, and it just went apart like that. Sailing went this way, that way, all over. Oh, it was a mess. My name is Master Sergeant Thomas D. Davis, U.S. Marine Corps. I joined the Navy in 1939. I stayed in the Navy 10 years, and then I joined the Marine Corps and stayed in Marine Corps 20 years. And I retired in 1968. Well, I was about less than 2 miles from the battleship room. And when they started bombing, when that first plane came over and dropped his bomb, then he went back. And then, oh hell broke loose. Then a lot of planes came over. Yeah, see, they had all those battleships in a row. I think it was about three or four battleships. They all would park over there. It wasn't too much they could do, you know. Our planes the one that wasn't hit, they got out, you know, and went out to and set the Japanese and fight them off, and that's when all the hell broke loose. Got some of our planes got off the ground, but not too many at Hickam Field. But see, they thought in their mind, if they knock out the battleship, they had it made because they could land. And those carriers saved us. Because they had those fighters and the intercept plane out there on them, you know, carriers. And they intercept those Japanese was coming in. And that's what saved us. There's a lot of smoke and fire, a lot of fire. Ship in there got sunk too, right there in the harbor. I know it lasts all that morning. And at night, the submarine tried to attack, and I think they got them. No, because I was shook up too, and my poker was on the Arizona at the time. I was watching all that fire was going on. And everything was burning over there, smoke. You couldn't hardly see the harbor on that side. The guy that went in the Navy with me, he was on Arizona. So he had the duty that morning, and I was off. So he told me, said, Dave said, why don't you come over and spend the night with me, and then we'll go up in town the next day. I said, heck, I'll stay on my own ship. Today he not here. Just looking. That's all I could do, because our battle station was the on the ship, they called it the sick bay, to take care of the wounded, you know, when they come in. I watched the whole thing. Yeah. It was something, I'm telling you, it's something I never want to see again.
My name is Tom Mahoney. I'm 89 years old. I'm from Union, New Jersey. And I'm one of the few Pearl Harbor survivors left in New Jersey. My most vivid memory of December 7th, 1941 was I had breakfast with five of my best friends that we went through boot camp together less than a year ago. And we had breakfast. We planned to go to Mass on one of the battleships at 8 o'clock. We were waiting for the launch. I went down to the electric shop where I was a striker. And while waiting, we heard boom, 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 and the ship began to roll. I looked out the porthole on the next deck up to see a plane dropping its torpedoes into the old Utah. These five boys went to their general quarter stations. We were all dressed in dress whites, ready to go to shore, church. And the next time I saw my friends was around 3 o'clock when the handling room of Gun Mount 3 cooled down and we opened the door and they were nothing but charcoal. They had taken the full blast of the bomb. This is etched in my brain and never will be forgotten. Later in the evening, when everything cooled down, all the metal, I went through the wreckage down to the main deck where there was four or five fellows looking at a huge sunset. It's the biggest one I ever seen in my life. I says, you will pay for this over and over again. I turned to the fellow next to me, which all of us were covered with oil, blood, soot from the fires, and we couldn't tell each other apart. our new dress whites that we're going to go ashore in were torn and black. I turned to the fellow next to me on the rail. I said, "Did you hear anything about the Mahoney boys?" He says, "Who the hell are you?" I says, "I'm Tom Mahoney." He says, "I'm your brother Harold." We hugged and cried like the kids we really were. We've been a close-knit association for many, many years. And each one of us considered the other person a brother. We got to know their families, and we'll never forget. And I will continue to carry on what I've been doing for years, and that's talking to children in high schools and presenting certain associations with a piece, a relic of the Arizona. And I will always remember all the people that I associated with for many, many years. God bless them all, and we love you. Thank you.
My name is Herb Weatherwax. I was born in Honolulu on June 3rd, 1917. I heard a very loud explosion in Honolulu. And I looked in the direction of the explosion, and that was over Pearl Harbor. And I saw the sky just black with smoke, a big cloud of smoke. And I could hear the anti-aircraft guns firing. I could hear that boom, 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 which is a sound I was familiar with because they used to have dry runs in that particular area. So I turned the radio on to find out what was going on, and they announced over the radio that all military personnel report to the station immediately. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. It was more than the material damages that was done. It affected the lives of all the young men that were here at that time, that were involved and was entrapped in the ships that was bombed, and especially the Arizona. I visited Memorial quite frequently and get to talk to the people about how it was that morning, how I saw it. When I was called back to my station, I got on a bus in Honolulu, and the bus is a regular transportation that troops had at that time to go to Honolulu and back to Schofield Barracks. And as I passed by the Arizona right at the entrance of the bay, I looked out and I was just shocked to see such a huge ship just enveloped in flames. The flames were so huge. And the sight that I saw there with all the other battleships ablaze, and the Oklahoma had been already torpedoed and she flipped over on the side. And I remember seeing little objects scrambling on the hull of the Oklahoma. Those are the things that left a tremendous impression on my mind. I volunteered for the visitor center because this is an opportunity for me to give my story out to the hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of visitors that come out here. I have a story to pass on to let them know how things were to be and they should be. And I think that the people, every American, if it's possible, should come to Hawaii and visit the memorial. Especially, never miss the memorial. That's very, very important.
their stories, their voices. December 7th, 1941. I'm James Bostic. Thank you for joining us here at Appointment in Time.